If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code, a lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM, let's create.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Hey, everyone. This is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets, in the car while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This summer, click into cordless power with Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. And keep your flower beds looking fresh with the 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Then clear leaves and debris with the 40-volt leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at the Home Depot and on HomeDepot.com. How doers get more done.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Julie, what is the worst map that you've ever created or had to use?
Oh, man. I don't know. I love to draw maps. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like all the maps that I've created have been brilliant.
And these are maps like how to get to places.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not like a cartographer on the side or anything. But no, I don't feel like I've done anything too crazy. My daughter recently created a map, and I was pretty impressed. She had China, the United States as like a blue blob, Europe as a yellow blob, and then Butterfly Land.
Wow. Butterfly.
Yeah, they had little wings. So I don't know. I wouldn't say that's the worst map, but I don't think it was very practical.
Still, it's interesting, and we'll have to think about Butterfly Land as we dive into this podcast, as we talk about our brains and maps and how this map ends up informing the world around us. When I think of bad maps I've had to use, probably the worst was when Yosemite National Park.
Mm-hmm.
There was like just a map that was not an official map. It was like handed out like maybe by somebody at the hotel that had that showed different locations around this little town, different trails, and none of it was really to scale. So you got a really warped sense of distance when you tried to go out and traverse any of this.
I will say hotel maps are pretty bad because they just want to show you the landmarks.
Yeah.
And they just are like, that's all that tourists really care about. They'll figure it out on their
own. Don't worry about the distances. Don't worry about whether it's walkable or you need to set aside a day to travel this distance. Just take our word for it that it's there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You'll see it just like on the map, this huge thing just on the horizon. So, of course, yes, we're talking about maps today. We're talking about how we have our own sort of autobiographical element to maps that we'll talk about. And we should probably kick this off with allegorical maps.
Yes, allegorical maps. Maps that are not so much of places. I mean, they can be of places, but they're about much more than that. When you put in a location into Google Maps or Apple Maps or whatever you're using, generally you're getting a pretty ironed out idea of where point A is in relation to point B, mm-hmm. between two physical locations. With an allegorical map, point A and point B may not be things that are precisely real. They might be states of mind, states of being. Point A might exist in this world. Point B might exist in some mythical other world.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about this in terms of Dante, mm-hmm. particularly when I thought back to our previous podcast that dealt with the sins and his sort of allegorical map of how you are traversing this mountain until you can, you know, scale all these different sins and wash yourselves of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Certainly with his map of hell, he relied on a lot of older maps and models. People have been sort of trying to figure out what a hell might look like and mapping that out for some time. But purgatory is certainly more of a purely allegorical map because it's more precisely about this journey from a state of sin, but, you know, acceptable level of sin, through cleanliness up the mountain and into heaven. So it's about the journey of the human soul.
And there's another allegorical map I wanted to mention, and this one is called The Road to Success. And apparently this was really popular circa 1910.
Uh-huh.
I love this map. It is in a book called Maphead by Ken Jennings. Yes, that Ken Jennings.
Jeopardy.
Mm-hmm. And it depicts an actual road winding up a mountain in a similar way that Dante considered the landscape. And success is depicted as a lyre at the very top. But at the bottom, all these different things you have to go through that might prevent you from having success, including bohemianism mm-hmm. at the base of this mountain. And it looks like a beer garden.
Yes, it looks like a fun place you might stop in. But his whole argument, if you stop in there, you might never leave.
Right. You can't even get up to the, you know, halfway up the mountain, right?
But it looks a lot more attractive than the pit of illiteracy.
The pit of illiteracy,
which just shows like tiny figures plummeting into this dark abyss.
There's also the Mutual Admiration Society in which, and this is what I love because it really is in the spirit of the times, people are telling each other things like, "You'll set the world on fire. You're a wonder, my boy." So, you know, you can get caught up in that. But anyway, you go up and up and up and you go through true knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But you, of course, have to traverse lack of preparation until you go through the gate of ideals, and finally you have found success.
It should be a board game because it reminds me a lot of the game of life, which in its own sense is kind of an allegorical map transformed into a board game.
Well, and that's what I think is interesting about this, is it is instructional. It is, of course, as you say, not going to tell you how to get from, you know, point A to point B in terms of, you know, day-to-day, like, how do I just navigate the world? But it does tell you in some sense, this is the direction that you should take. Here are the pitfalls.
But of course, a lot of people are probably thinking, well, an allegorical map, again, this is a map of something that is not real. It's a map of something that is not a physical location. It doesn't really deal with geography. It's dealing with abstract ideas and things that exist only in our heads. But the crazy thing is when you start looking at maps and our history with maps and even mm-hmm. our future with maps, that same description applies to even our more hard-boiled maps that deal with physical locations. We're still bringing in all of this mental junk and laying that out as part of the map-making process.
It's true. Like, think about the last time that you just jotted down a quick map for someone and gave them directions.
Mm-hmm.
As you were doing that and you were saying, here's the gas station on the left, you know, there's all these different memories that you have flooding your brain about that gas station, or here's the school I went to, or so on and so forth. So you might be putting landmarks on there, but it's all informed by your past experience.
Yeah. And even as you just find yourself like driving around town or taking the train to work, inevitably you're crossing things, you're passing by things that have some sort of significance to yourself, and they start ticking off in the background. You know, you're kind of like, oh, that's the place I had that really good sandwich that time. That's that place where that spider leapt out of my soup. I don't know. You know, whatever the memory may be, we can't help but build an informal map out of those experiences.
Yeah, I was thinking about the writer Pat Conroy as well. He's a Southern writer in the United States, and a lot of his fiction draws upon the landscape and the sort of stories it tells. Mm-hmm. And he has a semi-famous quote that says, "My wound is geography. It's also my anchorage and my port of call." So if you think about this, map is really storytelling. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, drawing from our experience, but also our imagination of what could be. And this is probably what we're all trying to get to right now is, you know, the million-dollar question. What is happening in our brains when we are considering maps in terms of our own personal autobiography, but also just trying to navigate the world?
I guess what we need to think about then is the brain in absence of the map. You know, what happens when the map is almost entirely internalized? And one of the best examples of that, the one that we've actually studied scientifically, has to do with the London cab drivers.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people out there have heard about this, the fact that their hippocampuses are larger than non-cab drivers in London. But before we talk about that a little bit more, I wanted to just sort of lay out the landscape of London for everyone. The streets that comprise the city, they sprawl beyond Greater London, and they are a tangle of ancient
yes.
streets. And people have actually referred to them before as a plate of spaghetti.
Yeah, this isn't like a modern U.S. city where somebody came out, laid out a bunch of grid work, and said, all right, you're going to put streets here going down, streets here going across, a park here, and that's going to be the city.
Yeah, boom.
This is a place that it's more like sediment, city of sediment. Like, over the years, different layers have accumulated. And if you walk through London, you're looking over here. Here's this modern skyscraper that looks like a pickle. Here's some ancient Roman ruins.
Right.
Here's some sort of like mid 20th century sort of communist looking building that looks like just an ugly box. And it's all just a complete, it's like history threw up this city, and you have to sort of navigate the chunks and have to adjust to bits that is London.
It's true. You have names that change just, you know, suddenly. There's not a lot of consistency with the way that the names go and are going through the actual city. And then you have a lack of house numbers on some streets.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't seem to be important to everyone in every location. And it can take a London cabbie 2 to 4 years of training to master the 25,000 streets that dart out in the 6 mile radius from Charing Cross area.
It's called the knowledge.
That's right. This training is a culmination of what they will finally sit down and be tested on, called, as you say, the knowledge. Which I love because it just sounds like so mysterious and wonderful, like you're about to go through a portal. But yeah, the knowledge is basically a series of sit down tests with an examiner who tells the cabbie where she or he wants to go. And then the cabbie has to tell the examiner the exact turn-by-turn route that he or she will take, including the side of the street that the journey begins on.
It reminds me a lot of Mark Twain's Life on the Mississippi, which I remember reading as a child and being dreadfully bored by it, because it's a lot of Mark Twain talking about being on the Mississippi and about how one navigates the Mississippi. But it was really similar in that you had these guys that had to just memorize, just had to commit to memory all of these details of the river and about its depth and which and how navigable different portions of the river were going to be at a given time.
Right, and that's actually what all of us are doing all the time, but London cab drivers in particular are really paying attention to
this,
right?
Yeah, they're dealing with a very complex street system, like you said. Numbers aren't necessarily where they need to be. You're dealing with the various flow and flux of traffic.
And as a result, their hippocampus, which is located in the brain's temporal lobe and is responsible for navigating, starts to get bigger and bigger. And the more years that they're on the job, the bigger the hippocampus.
All right. So most people who have a job that involves sitting, you might think, well, your rear end might grow over time. The rear end of the hippocampus grows over time, swells with this knowledge, if you will.
Yes, it does. But when you retire, it shrinks back down to normal. That's the thing. And also this is interesting too, when they actually did a couple of more follow-up tests, because the hippocampus was a 2000 study. And in 2008, they did a follow-up, and they found that the hippocampus was really only activated at the beginning of a trip, and then other parts of the brain started to take over.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AstaproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
You can work from the road while turning your vehicle into a powerful high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On a network that covers more roads than any other carrier, connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi to see if you're eligible for a free trial today. Based on independent third-party data, always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
You know, everybody has their own wellness routine, their own approach to a healthy lifestyle. A lot of the most successful ones include herbs like ginger root, ashwagandha, and so many others. Nature's Way has been sourcing herbs like those for over 50 years. They understand that nature is the ultimate problem solver, so they're dedicated to providing plant-powered formulas to help people live healthier lives. Their herbs can support your health in so many ways. For instance, ginger root and slippery elm bark have both been used for centuries all over the world. Ginger root has traditionally been used to soothe occasional digestive upset and slippery elm bark to soothe the GI tract. St. John's wort, holy basil, and ashwagandha can provide mood and stress support, which is something we can all use in our modern life. I mean, these herbs come from all over the world, but Nature's Way knows where the best ones grow. They test for potency in their state-of-the-art lab, and their scientists are experts in all things herbs. What's on the label is what's in your bottle, and what's in your bottle are the best herbs around. To learn more, visit naturesway.com.
And there have been some studies, too, that have suggested that there's a trade-off in cognitive talents, that as a taxi driver becomes more and more equipped to navigate this complex road system, their other modes of memory kind of dim just a little bit.
Really?
So the back swells, the front portion shrinks a little.
Huh, okay. Well, there you go. I wanted to also talk about neurons and how they are influencing the way that we actually are able to follow directions. According to Barbara Trusky in her article, Distortions in Memory for Maps, we have neurons in our brains that are biased toward horizontal and vertical arrangements, which I think is trippy in and of itself. In fact, the neurons greatly outnumber the neurons that are dedicated to diagonal arrangement. But when you start to think about our planet, mm-hmm. which is biased on this XY axis, it begins to make sense because we have really strong verticals in the trees that we see, right?
Right.
And then the ground provides a flat horizon, and even when you look out, you see the horizon. So it makes sense that we evolved to have more neurons that would appreciate this XY axis.
So we're more in line with the rook on a chessboard. Just up and down, side
yes.
to side.
Yes, and think
not
about
not so much a bishop or a queen,
right? And think about those trees as sort of proto landmarks mm-hmm. for all animals, really. And then I was reminded of that sleight of hand trick that we discussed when we talked about the science of magicians.
Yes,
and the fact that not just magicians use this trick, but pickpocketers also will take advantage of the fact that we have this XY axis. And they do this by moving their hands in an arc rather than horizontally.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that we have saccades, and these are the fastest movements in the human body, and it occurs in our eyes, right? And they automatically move their gaze to the end point of what they think is going to happen. So if you were to move your hand horizontally, then you could track it really well. But pickpocketers, magicians, illusionists, they all do this sort of arc because it's very hard to track it accurately and you're distracted.
It also reminds me of zigzagging, like the whole deal, an alligator's chasing you, right? What do you do?
Yeah.
You run diagonal.
That's right.
Mess with their ability to determine when something is actually moving sideways.
And if you think that that's not enough of a case to say that we prefer this sort of XY axis, think about the London Tube map.
Yes, back to London, the fabulous London Tube map, where it's really, and I'm fairly new to all of this. I've been to London. I've certainly used that tube map to get around before, but I really never stopped to realize how important it was and how groundbreaking that mm-hmm. map design was. And certainly you see its influence everywhere. You see various versions of it. You see other public transportation systems that mimic that style. It's become sort of something of a modern art motif.
Yeah, it's definitely iconic. And the reason why it works so well is that it plays again to the XY axis. Harry Beck is the person who designed this map in 1933. Or rather, he did it a couple years before that, but they mm-hmm. didn't adopt it until 1933. And what he did is he took all those squirrely lines that played with spaghetti and tried to make sense of it by only delineating all the stations and the connecting stations in 45-degree angles. So the effect, while being really modern to the eye, I think, is that it really cleaned up that space and it made it much more logical for people to understand the system.
And it really becomes one's understanding of the city. That's what really fascinates me.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you tend to sort of define your space based on the roads and paths you have to travel. Like here in Atlanta, we live in a pretty non-complex city as far as public transportation goes. We got north and south, east and west. We've got 85 and 75 going up the center. We've got mm-hmm. 20 going through in the middle. So it's pretty simple.
And then you have the highway 285 looping
around and trapping everybody inside, because that's our plan, is that you just roar enough traffic through there, then the zombies can't get in or out, depending on what the scenario is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's difficult to not think about one's surroundings in those terms, like thinking about where are you in terms of the perimeter. I mean, here in Atlanta, people tend to talk about things being OTP, outside the perimeter.
Like, yeah.
You do not want to go OTP. Even if you have a friend that lives out there, God bless them, but they're OTP and they just invited you to dinner, you might have to make up an excuse, that kind of thing. And then inside the perimeter is the preferred distance of travel. And then you think of it in those different sections. You know?
That's right. The mental map mm-hmm. does actually map to the system that is in place. And apparently this London Tube map was so important to so many people that when they made changes to it, there was a big whoa, what are you doing?
You've changed our reality, basically.
Yeah.
You've changed the thing that forms the world that we live in.
Even though this map is inaccurate, right? Because nothing's at the 45-degree angle that it's depicted in. Mm-hmm. It was still like, that's how I see London, at least for some people.
Right.
Other people sort of said, this is fine, it's more accurate. But, you know, that's what happens when something becomes iconic, I suppose.
Well, I think that's what's ultimately at heart when people had this reaction to Pluto losing its planet status, you know? Like, ultimately, nobody really cares about Pluto, really. It's out there. It's not really
nobody
a planet.
Nobody really has a stake in Pluto.
Yeah, Pluto's a long ways off and pretty insignificant compared to the other planets. But it was part of that map that we mm-hmm. grew up seeing. And that map was how we defined our place in the solar system and in the universe at large. And suddenly that changed, and people were like, whoa, that changes everything in a small and perhaps insignificant way to normal life and the way you live your daily life. But it's still shifted your universe.
Yeah, and it's funny because even though we know life is something that is constantly changing, mm-hmm. that we're just transients here, really, all of us, we still can't help but try to nail things down and say, this is not going to change. So we're going to map it.
Yes.
We're going to look up at the night sky and say, that belongs to us. And yeah, anytime sort of those things are tinkered with, it reminds us of this transient quality of life.
Yeah, anyone who has a GPS device that's not attached to their phone knows this deal. Because like with me, I know that there is a way to take it and hook it up to a computer and probably pay some stupid sum of money to get the maps updated.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a lot of trouble and money I don't want to spend. So I end up with old maps. So it'll occasionally send us in a direction towards a street that is no longer there,
yeah,
or it will
yeah.
ignore a street that it doesn't know exists yet.
Yep.
And there's there is something troubling about it. You're like, why are the roads changing? Why is the world changing around me? The map should have kept it as it is.
Yeah, that happened to me recently, and the road just dead-ended. Mm-hmm. And it was supposed to go for like another 20 miles. And nothing makes you feel more helpless than relying on, you know, a clunky GPS.
Yes.
To feel like a rube in the middle of nowhere and appreciate maps, at least the written ones. So I did want to bring this up about Americans and their apparent ability to excel at directions.
Ah.
Okay. Geographer Harm de Bilge has made the claim that we Americans...
And he's Dutch, correct?
He's German.
German.
That we have a better sense of direction than our European counterparts that live in these sort of spaghetti-streeted cities, because we have exercised that part of our brain, because we are so used to this grid-like system in the United States, where most major cities are very logical and planned out on this XY axis.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you could make a case for that. Certainly in something like when you go to a city like Savannah, Georgia. You know, where they have the, like, it's pretty laid out on a grid, or the main part of the city is anyway. And you have, here's a street, and here's a street coming from the other direction, here's a park, here's, mm-hmm. It's like a grid work. It's like a board for a card game.
Yeah, and even though they have the parks, they have successive parks, and so there's a pattern of that, and so you know that you're gonna have to go around these parks in X, Y, Z configuration. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there you go. But I think it's surprising to people, because when you think about Americans and you think about maps, and our ability to actually find other countries on the map, it's pretty dismal.
Well, you know, we've talked before about how much our brain likes to find patterns and recognize patterns. So there were these pattern recognition engines. So there's something comforting about knowing that, all right, well, in another street, I know about what's going to happen. There's going to be a park up there. Or in another couple of streets, there's going to be this or that. You know, it's a you want this regularity in your world around you.
Yeah, and for all the people out there, when you go on vacation and you're the map person, this is for you. I don't know if you guys like to do this, but I love to study the map beforehand so that I do start to create some sort of reality of this new city for myself and my brain, and orient myself as quickly as possible.
I tend to wait more towards the last minute to do that, but I do find there's something satisfying about it. Like when you're actually on the, like, flying into this city, and so the city in a sense is about to become real mm-hmm. to you, then I engage with the map and I start looking at it, and I, you know, see where I'm going to be, what's around it, where I can eat in the general vicinity, and the place becomes a little more real before I get there.
And I'm already imagining that, which we'll talk about in a moment. We're going to take a break. When we get back, we are going to talk about this idea of maps from our imagination that become completely real to us.
Probiotics aren't a trend anymore. They're a mainstay in the health and wellness aisle of your favorite store. And Nature's Way Women's Probiotic Pearls are the easiest way to introduce a probiotic into your routine. I mean, they're just what they sound like, adorable little pearls that couldn't be easier to take, but they still pack that probiotic punch. Each tiny pearl has 1 billion active cultures and protect against occasional bloating, constipation, and digestive discomfort. And they actually support both digestive and vaginal health, so that's a win-win. And according to my little fact sheet here, they're designed with a triple layer coating that protects each pearl from stomach acid, so they can make it all the way to your small intestine where they're needed most. You probably didn't think we'd be talking about the small intestine today, did you? Well, digestive health is kind of important. If you know, you know. To learn more about Nature's Way Women's Probiotic Pearls and how they can fit into your routine, visit naturesway.com.
You can work from the road while turning your vehicle into a powerful high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On a network that covers more roads than any other carrier, connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi to see if you're eligible for a free trial today. Based on independent third-party data, always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X, and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured. Not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
All right, we're back, and we're going to talk about maps as they relate to storytelling and the creation of unreal places.
And memory.
We've talked before about the memory palace, of course, and this is the method where you use our fabulous gift for spatial processing and use that to create an imagined place full of the things that you need to memorize.
Yeah, and think about it this way, too. When you go into a room and you perceive a room, you're not just getting an image of the room. What you're perceiving is actually your mind creating those dimensions of a room for you. So that's very important in terms of how we remember things and how we map out our worlds.
Yeah, like anytime you check out a new restaurant, right? Mm-hmm. Your brain has to develop that map to the bathroom. And then once you have that data, it's important. It's valuable. And you share it with other people. The other person at the table goes to get up and they're like, do you know where the bathroom is? And like, yes, let me share that mental map with you.
Yeah, you're like, okay, see that fabulous mustachioed man over there? Take a right, and so on and so forth. See how it becomes very much a part of what sticks out to you in your memory. And this is one of the bedrocks of this memory palace idea of how you can create a whole world in your mind and remember a bunch of random things by tagging them to these surreal objects of this story that you tell yourself.
I also can't help but be reminded of the mandala, which comes from the Sanskrit for circle. And this is a motif you see again and again, especially in Tibetan Buddhism, where it is essentially one uses this image to help build this virtual place in one's mind. You have a map on paper or on canvas or in sand, and you use that to form this spiritually significant map in your mind. And then that's used for meditation.
So what I think is interesting about this is that you're basically talking about the intersection between reality and imagination.
Yes.
And we've seen this used, not necessarily the mandala per se, but the idea of this transposing your imagination onto reality in fiction.
Yes.
And I was thinking about Token and how important that is as a narrative device to create this world for the readers that you can begin to reference because you're taking a bird's eye view of this world that Tolkien has created.
Yes, definitely the maps of Middle-earth in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, those were really big for me early on. Before I was able to read those books, because my dad had them in these like tattered paperbacks, I remember like in third grade, probably even younger, getting those out, and I would look at the maps, and the maps amazed me, you know, because you're poring over this data, and you're looking at things like Mirkwood, and you're looking at the place where the hobbits live. You're looking at where the evil creatures live in Mordor, and you're forming this this worldview. And then as you get older and you deal with these maps too, you're trying to figure out what is this model after? What does this represent in the real world, either geographically or politically?
Because you're building up layers of this world,
right? Yeah, so you're looking like, all right, how do I interpret this map in terms of the actual Earth? How do I interpret it in terms of the world as the author was seeing it in those days? It's really fascinating, and it's become a hallmark certainly of any kind of world creating fantasy, be it the works of say George R. R. Martin, who's really big right now. Game of Thrones, the TV series based on his work, actually starts off with a map. It's like a sweeping computer animated map of the world in which the show takes place. Other big examples of that, R. Scott Baker's Second Apocalypse books. He has a really awesome map of the three C's in there. So you're poring over that and you're trying to figure out, all right, well, is this portion of the map? This is kind of his Middle East, I guess. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of his Baltic region. And then this is where he's put the iconic evil portion of the planet. It's fascinating to think of all that stuff. And also, it's also interesting to think of the authors who create a map but don't actually share that with the readers. Because certainly, if you're engaging in world creation, you're creating a new planet, new cultures, new geography. All of this stuff needs to come together in a form that the author understands in order to write about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, like a lot of the stuff that later came out from Tolkien, it's stuff that he never intended for a wider audience to view. He wrote that for himself so that he could create these books.
So a map for yourself so that you, the writer, could then write the story.
Yeah.
Which I think is fascinating.
Yeah, one of my favorite authors is a guy named Brian McNaughton, and he wrote a book called Throne of Bones, which all takes place in the same dark fantasy setting. And I am told that he, and I understand from what I've read about him, he did have a map of this world that he'd mm-hmm. created. But it's never been published. As far as I know, no one outside of a small number of people has ever seen it. Because his characters were not the kind of people who engaged in a sweeping understanding of their own world.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, say, Gandalf in Lord of the Rings, like, he's the kind of guy who would watch whatever Middle Earth's version of BBC News was, you know. He'd be the one who would tune in and be like, I wonder what the weather's going to be tomorrow. Wonder what's going on in up there in Hobbit country. You know, he would have that wider understanding. Whereas the characters in Brian McNaughton's book, they were more concerned with their day-to-day and maybe, you know, figuring out what they were going to eat in the next hour or whatever their own petty sufferings happened to be.
So the reader didn't need the bird's eye
right,
view
yeah.
in that sense. I was thinking about how place is so incredibly important in fiction, in our own lives, obviously. And then I was thinking about as a guy named Austin Tappan Wright. And he is someone who took his childhood creation of a country called Islandia into adulthood with him. So I don't. When you were younger, did you ever create a sort of fantasy world? Or
yes, all the time because I pretty early on I got into Dungeons and Dragons,
mm-hmm.
Which the various supplements you would get into Dungeons and Dragons would come with maps, which were all pretty fascinating. I remember one supplement in particular had treasure maps.
Yeah,
that you could use,
yeah.
and so I would inevitably end up plotting out my own little scenarios and own little world. So I would draw out all these maps. And then later when I got into actually writing and attempting to write fiction, I would also envision these fantastic worlds and try and map them out on paper and also in my own head. And I guess I'm still doing that.
Well, my brother and I also did this, and we came up with Marijuana Island. We did not know what marijuana meant. But
uh-huh.
Kranja was this ape who ruled this island. But
oh,
anyway,
wait, what was his name?
Kranja.
Kranja.
Don't ask me
well,
why.
That sounds like that would be a great bit of slang for it, you know?
Yeah,
kranja.
Like kranja.
It sounds a lot like ganja.
Going to Marijuana Island to get some kranja.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, we never sort of took this world with us into adulthood. But this guy that I talked about, Austin Tappan Wright, his Islandia, he took from his boyhood, and he spent 20 years off and on developing this world. And talking about it, it's really exhaustively, like the geography, mm-hmm. the people, the language, he made up a language for them, the politics, the laws. And this, he said, was a small kingdom at the southern tip of the Karain subcontinent. I mean, he really put a ton of thought into this. He created maps for it. And at the time of his death at 48, he was in a car accident, unfortunately. He had 2,300 longhand pages dedicated to this world that he made up, this country, actually. And his wife and then later his daughter pared it down to 1,000 pages and published it in 1942. It was a sensation.
Wow.
Because it really captured people's imaginations. I mean, here is someone who made such an authentic world for others to enjoy. He did not intend that, of course. It was his own personal obsession. But I do think it's fascinating that he was able to weave together country to the point where people just wanted to go there. And he even said on his own travels across the world, he would look at something, and his family said that he would look out the mountains and say, ah, that reminds me of Islandia. That's how real it was in his brain.
Well, and then it makes you wonder, too. We were talking about how the world around us forms a map, but then the maps that we have form that world for us. So to what extent is this created world of his more real than the real world that he inhabits, you know?
Yeah.
The more he knew it better than the actual real world.
I think he did. I mean, think about this. It started in his childhood, let's say around 10 years old, up until he was 48 years old.
Wow.
It dominated the most of his life.
It reminds me a little bit of this author by the name of M.A.R. Barker, and he was a professor of Urdu and South Asian studies. Really, really brilliant man, you know, just steeped in the lore and history and geography of Asia. And he created, in his spare time, you know, his full-time professor most of his career, but in his spare time, he created a fantasy setting called Tekumel, and that's T-E-K-U-M-E-L.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really cool website that has all the stuff on it. And he ended up writing a few different sort of pulpy but very creative fantasy novels set there, and also one of the earliest, like a contemporary of Dungeons & Dragons role-playing game. And it's just like really, really rich setting, kind of like imagine Lord of the Rings, except instead of based upon Western and Norse models of mythology, based entirely upon Eastern motifs and models. And that's basically the world that M.A.R. Barker created. He sadly died, I think, last year, but certainly created one of those worlds where you feel like this world was more real for him. Maybe by only a certain margin, but still almost as real as the real world that he concerned himself with.
And I think it's interesting how we can't help but create this sort of map, whether or not we're doing it. Know that we're doing it. You know what I'm saying? Whether or not we know that we're sitting down like Austin Tappan Wright and creating this whole mythology, or just in our heads when we're randomly thinking about our lives, you know, how much of that is this sort of map construct. And we will talk more about maps, the history of maps, and a bit more about the science of it in a couple other podcasts, but we wanted to touch on this idea of maps as storytelling.
Yeah.
So I'm going to leave you with a little quote from Maphead, from Ken Jennings. He says, and he, of course, is someone who loves maps, is a Maphead. He says, maps are just too convenient and too tempting a way to understand place. There's a tension in them. Almost every map will show us two kinds of places, places where we've been and places where we've never been. The nearby and the far away exist together in the same frame, our world undeniably connected to the new and unexpected. We can understand at a glance our place in the universe, our potential to go and see new things, and the way to get back home afterward.
Very nice. All right, well, let's call the robot over here, and we'll read a quick listener mail. All right, this one comes to us from Scott, who's writing about our bats episode. He says, hi, guys, I love the podcast. I listen while I'm at work all alone on second shift, and it informs me as well as entertains. I love the show about bats. The first thing I thought of is about when I go mountain biking at night in the woods. Bats will swoop down and fly along in front of us, staying in the beam of our helmet lights. Sometimes they are 20 feet away, and sometimes they are close enough to see the hairs on their body and hear their leathery wings flapping. It doesn't happen all the time, but a half dozen times a year is thrilling. Second, when we were kids, we would throw pebbles up in the air at dusk and watch the bats come zipping in to intercept the pebbles, probably thinking it was a juicy bug meal. I know it sounds cruel now, but we were kids and we didn't hurt the bats. We didn't throw anything at them. Last, I live in an old house, and once every few years, we'll have a bat visitor, usually in early summer, flapping around the house. My surefire way to safely remove them is to hold up a sheet or blanket and slowly walk them into a corner and then gently lower the blanket to the floor. Pick it up and ever so gently bring it outside and unfurl. I haven't lost a bat yet this way. Thanks again, Scott.
All right. Bat catcher.
Yeah, so if you guys have anything you would like to share, certainly about bats and catching bats safely in your household, that kind of thing, or about maps, what's your relationship with maps? Do you have memories of, like I feel a lot of us do, of looking at these maps as a kid before you really had any understanding of the world, trying to piece it together from that map on the wall?
Looking at faraway places, wondering what it's like.
Or certainly the old maps. I remember we had one of these old world maps on the wall when I was a kid, where all the continents are kind of malformed and kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
And there may have been a dragon or two. There'd be dragons, right? Let us know what you think about all that. And if you're into fantasy, what do you think about the fantasy worlds that your favorite authors create in map form? What are some of your favorite maps of unreal places? We'd love to hear about it. You can find us on Tumblr and Facebook. On both of those, we are Stuff to Blow Your Mind. And you can also find us on Twitter, where our handle is Blow the Mind.
And you can always drop us a line at blowthemind@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.